I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday Friday. Doug Fine is one of the nation's experts on the politics and economics of marijuana. The author of Too High to Fail reacts to Maryland's recent decriminalization of the possession of small amounts of pot. And he describes what industrial researchers see as immense potential in legalized hemp agriculture in the United States. Doug Fine joins us for Midday Friday. So does Munir Bahar, founder of the 300 Men March in Baltimore. He's trying to recruit a few more good Baltimoreans to join his effort to stop gun violence among young men in the city. And a real treat today, French guitarist Pierre Bensouzin. He's in Maryland for a benefit concert tonight in Baltimore County. We'll hear him perform live from Studio A. First, the news from NPR. And welcome to Midday Friday, everyone. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us. It's the second Friday of the month. It's time again for Midday Eats with Hong and Shields. John Shields of Gertrude's and Henry Hong of Waterfront Kitchen will be joining us in the second hour of our show today. We'll talk about leftovers, what to do with leftovers, and there'll be the Midday Leftovers Challenge in the second hour of our show. You get a chance to call in from your refrigerator at home, tell us what's in it, and Henry and John will tell you what you can do with it. Adaptive reuse of food coming up, our leftover challenge in the second hour of our show today. Also, a pretty nice treat for you today, guitarist Pierre Bensouzin in Baltimore for a concert tonight in Baltimore County to benefit Turnaround's anti-sex trafficking program. Pierre will step into our studio at 12:30, and you'll hear some of this live. Also today, Paula Gallagher of the Baltimore County Public Library has two new books to recommend before the hour's out. We start the show, though, with Doug Fine, journalist, solar-powered goat farmer who tweets as Organic Cowboy, and author of a great book on the politics and economics of marijuana called Too High to Fail. Doug is out with another book on what he calls the next agricultural revolution, hemp growing. Doug, welcome back to Midday.
Dan, it's great to be with you, because in previous conversations, we sort of predicted and felt that this day might come, that is, hemp returning to the U.S. economy.
Yeah, I remember in our first conversation about this, this is a learning experience for me, because I didn't realize that hemp was actually illegal, that it is produced in other countries, but not here.
Yeah, and that's already changing. From where I stand right now in Colorado, farmers are growing commercial levels, commercial cultivation with state permits of industrial cannabis, also known as hemp. And personally, after researching the hemp industry and its history for a couple of years, I think that's a very good sign for the country and for humanity.
I'm advised to ask you right off the bat whether you can actually smoke your drapes if they're made of hemp. So
right.
Separate this out for us a little bit, marijuana
and
hemp.
The knowledge base is coming back to us, to humanity, really, about hemp at such a fast rate that sometimes I have to give the basic definition of hemp, and sometimes people want to know, yeah, but what seed oil application gets, you know, profits me most per acre or something like that. So there's such a wide knowledge range. So let's not assume anything. Hemp is one of humanity's longest utilized plants. It's a variety of the cannabis plant, so its leaves look like psychoactive cannabis, but that's where the similarities end. Basically, hemp is defined as any version of the cannabis plant with less than 0.1% THC, that psychoactive component that allowed, you know, Woodstock to happen.
Right, right. And what are the industrial uses of it?
Oh my gosh, where should I begin? I guess I should start with where today Canadian farmers have built a nearly billion-dollar industry that's growing 24% annually. They can't even keep up with the acreage that they need to plant of this. So it's real money on the ground for real farmers. Believe me when I tell you, Dan, this is why North Dakotans, Coloradans, Kentuckians are on board the hemp train. There's no politics associated with this. It is pure business. The Canadians are, this is on the hemp seed oil, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
It's a nutritive product. The U.S. Consumers buy 90% of the Canadian crop because we're just not allowed to cultivate it here. We can import it. So it's very exciting to see, as appreciative as I am to the Canadians for starting their modern hemp industry back in 1998 and showing us how it's done. Now, a New Mexican, I want to be able to either press my own family's hemp oil from our own hemp crop or at least be able to get a regional farmer's co-op of hemp seed oil. And it is this, I did some university research for Hempbound, the book, and I looked into university research, I should say, and it is a nutritive superfood. All the things that your roommate with the lava lamp said about hemp are true. The seed oil is basically a perfect food.
Doug Fine's latest book is Hemp Bound. He just mentioned the title. The subtitle, Dispatches from the Front Lines of the Next Agricultural Revolution. So, Doug, a little bit more about industrial application besides the one you just described.
Sure. Okay, so that's the oil side, and that's where most American farmers should start if they're sinking it into the soil now or soon. Side note, Dan, I'm sure you know, but many listeners might not know that in this year's Farm Bill, hemp was reauthorized to be grown in the U.S. for the first time in 77 years, but only for university research, at least for now. And it's a big step. It's a great start. Colorado's going further. I suspect other states will as well because of the profitable seed oil market. But after you've harvested the seeds, you're left with the fiber. And you can make with this fiber, oh gosh, I have to be careful not to sound like the roommate with the lava lamp, but this is real research I did in factories around the world. Today, hemp fiber is in BMW and Mercedes door panels. And that's not anything political. That's because it makes a strong, inexpensive, easily replicable fiber for, high-tech applications. I think in the U.S., it takes a lot of knowledge base to learn how to do the fiber applications with hemp. So I think the first fiber app that's going to take off big in the U.S. is going to be construction. And hempcrete, folks can YouTube it, look it up. It's a mixture of just chopped up hemp fiber mixed with lime, produces insulation material that outperforms, think fiberglass, and is actually produces carbon neutral homes because the hemp mixing with the lime sucks carbon out of the atmosphere. It's, again, I'm not holding up a lava lamp. I'm just reporting what the studies are saying. But hemp is going to be big.
Carbon neutral. It does sound a little too good to be true.
Yeah, so let's go on to the third app while we're already in the ether. what I'd like to see, this is I just did 5 hemp bound events here in Colorado, and every one of them I was pleading to Coloradans to do this, what I call in the book, tri-cropping. Grow for the profitable seed oil, make some other cool value-added product out of the fiber, mm-hmm. and in a third section of your factory, have this small energy-producing unit. It's a process called gasification, and it's a relatively carbon-friendly anaerobic farm waste combustion technique that's allowing entire farm communities in Europe to become completely fossil fuel-free and energy-independent on a community level. And they're not big units. They're not expensive. The Army's been buying them. You can just basically throw the leftover herd when you're done with those other two harvests into this machine and produce energy that sells back to the grid.
Wow. Doug, we had a phone call to the show the other day during our discussion about the Maryland legislature's vote to decriminalize possession of small amounts of marijuana. And the hemp came up in the conversation, and the gentleman who called in said that the petrol industry in the United States had a lot to do with the prohibition on hemp production in this country. Because petrol was coming along, plastics were coming along, and they didn't want hemp fiber competing with that. Is there any truth to that?
Well, there's no smoking gun. When I get asked this question, I say, let's go back to that paneled, oak-paneled club room above Washington or New York somewhere with Hearst and his highball and cigar chatting with the cotton moguls, chatting with the DuPont chemical moguls and saying, no, we can't let this hemp go. Let's let's tell everyone that the Negroes will go after their daughters. The newspapers did say that, but that's to sell newspapers. There's no smoking gun to show it was a conspiracy amongst oligarchs, I'll tell you this. I think industrial cannabis does present a threat to petroleum today. Once we have millions of acres, China's aiming for 3 million acres. Once we have millions of acres of industrial hemp covering North Dakota, Kentucky, Colorado, California, and traditional hemp states like Wisconsin, Missouri, and Ohio, Illinois, I think that we're seriously going to be weaning from petroleum via this as an energy source. Now, in hemp, I did already get to take a hemp-powered limo ride, Dan, and I know we don't have all day to talk about this stuff, but it was purportedly a limo once owned by Imelda Marcos, a Filipino, wife of the Filipino dictator. So you can today make fuel from hemp oil, but your thing is going to be this gasification process I told you about. Kentucky utilities are already thinking about it.
Right. Now, is it possible with genetic modification to remove the THC from it completely so that it, you know, those who are concerned about people smoking smoking hemp fiber will stop worrying about that and we'll have this industry?
Yeah, no, it's not necessary to do that because, so these are sort of the bullet points for people that are new to this and are wondering those issues, you know, when they just, you know, are tempted to wonder about any confusion with psychoactive cannabis, you know. It's absolutely impossible that there could ever be confusion. First of all, Canada's 15-year industry, now approaching $1 billion, their hemp industry, there has been exactly zero cases of confusion. What they've done is put their drug squads on the Canadian Royal Mounted Police to work inspecting the industry and supporting the industry. I'd love to see the DEA doing this. They inspect the crops, they test them. There's been no cases of confusion. And the reason they can't there can't be one is botanical. The moment that inert hemp pollen hits the manicured high THC medicinal or social cannabis plant, it's valueless. It loses its potency. It has seeds. There is literally no. It's compost. It's
I get
a $20,000 plant becomes worthless.
Huh.
So the two crops can't even be grown very close to each other. The other thing is that you know, in the field, a hemp crop is very densely grown. It looks like your amber waves of grain and your corn. It's the way that industrial agriculture works. Cannabis plants are manicured prima donnas that are, each one is sort of taken care of like a celebrity.
Hey, speaking of marijuana, I wanted to get your reaction to the vote in the Maryland legislature, removing criminality from the possession of 10 grams or less of pot in Maryland. What do you think of that? It's been lowered to a mere, you know, citation offense.
I'm really glad to be asked that question, Dan. Thank you, because I believe from the research from the previous book that you're kind enough to mention, Too High to Fail, I believe that cannabis prohibition is America's worst policy since segregation, and I don't say that lightly. The prison population we've created, the criminal syndicates we've enriched south of the border for a plant that humans have utilized for millennia and that is, by all accounts and every study, safer than alcohol. It's already providing revenue and having a completely positive effect here where I am this morning. Surrounded by prairie dogs, actually, in outside of Denver, Colorado. So cannabis prohibition must end, and I have an international perspective on this. I was asked to testify at the United Nations High Session on Narcotic Drugs a few weeks ago in Vienna in advance of a 2016 meeting that will hopefully change the international drug war, but the conventions and the treaties. But there I got, you know, you had countries like Pakistan and Iran talking about how the death penalty works, and Uruguay full-on legalizing cannabis. You have such a broad array of opinions. So I've come to the place that it's an inexorable and deserved march toward cannabis returning to the economy and to the above-ground life around the world.
Mm-hmm.
Humans have always used it everywhere, except Antarctica. So any advance, such as Maryland's, is to be admired. I mean, it's a huge political step. It's brave still. Let's admit it's brave still for politicians to talk, to take the truthful, best, safest action on drug policy, which is to end cannabis prohibition. And Maryland did it, so I applaud them. And I read your column about, dang, are you kidding me? That is not enough. And you're right, but I think it's a terrific first step.
Okay. Well, Doug, thank you very much for being with us today and for another book, a very interesting read here. It's called Hemp Bound, Dispatches from the Front Lines of the Next Agricultural Revolution by our guest, Doug Fine. He touched on this a bit in the earlier book, Too High to Fail, which is also recommended by Midday. Doug, thank you very much.
My pleasure. It's always great to be with you, Dan. Thanks for having me.
That's Doug Fine. This is Midday. Dan Rodrigues here. We're going to take our first break of the hour. Coming up, Munir Bahar, the founder of the 300 Men March in Baltimore, is trying to recruit a few more good Baltimoreans to join his effort to stop gun violence among young men in the city. And a real treat for you today, coming up in just a few more minutes, French guitarist Pierre Bensouzin. And welcome back to Midday on WYPR, Midday Friday. Dan Rodrigues here now with Munir Bahar, an accountant with a specialty in nonprofits, operator of a fitness and martial arts center called CORE, Committed Organized Responsible, C-O-R, and chief organizer of the 300 Men March Against Violence in Baltimore, which started last summer. Munir, welcome back to Midday. It's nice to see you again.
Thank you, as always, Dan.
I haven't talked to you in a little while, so how has this been going? You know, we touched base last summer, again in the fall. You're trying to keep the 300 Men March going. You know, the first rollout of it in the summer, something spawned because of the tragedy in Baltimore. We had this surge of violence back in the summer, again in January this year.
Yes.
So what have you been up to since I talked to you last, which was in the fall and going through the winter?
Well, at the end of January, we had a call to the entire city. We had a meeting down at City Hall. And what we presented down at City Hall was our plans for mobilization for this year. We've identified the two sort of highest areas of crime and gun violence, and those are our focus areas for this year for our 300 Men March activity. So we want to be more sort of coordinated in the areas that need it most with the manpower that we have. So
Where did you decide to focus?
The data tells us it's Sandtown, Winchester, and Bel Air Edison.
Okay.
The areas with the highest gun violence, rates of shootings and homicides. So that's our areas now. So we're mobilizing, and we're not waiting until, you know, June or July or, you know, for the things to spike up. We're trying to get people mobilized now. Two steps. One, get folks mobilized and have sort of the manpower to go in each of these two areas. And then two, connect with the pre-existing organizations in these areas and go to them and pretty much saying, hey, we're here to support you. You know, we're going to be on the streets. We're going to be engaging young folks on our own, but we're also here to strengthen the programs. And our goal is to have 50 volunteers in each area. And, you know, our sort of
people who actually live there or live elsewhere and come to those areas.
It'll be a combination of both. You know, that's how it's been so far. So people who are concerned, people who are willing to come out on Friday nights and engage the people that are out in this anti-violence movement.
And you do it on Friday nights?
Every Friday night.
Now, when the first march occurred on North Avenue, remember, that was really exciting because it was kind of spontaneous. All these people turned out. It was in July, I think, or August.
July 5th.
July 5th. You remember better than I do. But those, the men who came out to join you on that march and then the subsequent marches, are they still around? Are they still part of your group?
A very small group, about
30
men.
Small group of men have stayed with you.
Yes, about 30 men.
That's not that small, you know. Maybe you think it is, but I think 30 is a pretty good number to have stay with you consistently over time for this.
It is, but just realizing the severity of the violence in Baltimore, you know, we really need 300 because we're not trying to change things sort of over 10 years. You know, we want to change this culture as quickly as possible because every day, every month that goes by, we have an unwanted number of victims who are losing their lives to this violence on the street. And so, you know, while some can say, oh, it's going to take a while, we understand the natural order of life and how things progress. But, you know, a while, that's a lot of bodies. That's a lot of children losing parents. You know, that's a lot of frustration. That's a lot of funerals. So, you know, there is a sense of urgency on our work in terms of recruiting the necessary manpower to make a big enough impact that then influences the rest of the community.
For those who aren't familiar with what you actually do, what the 300 Men March actually does, it's not just a show of manpower. It's not just a show of force on the street. You actually go out and talk to young men on the corners. Explain a little bit about what you do.
So we usually get started around 8:30, and we just start to walk. And we walk through the areas that have been hit the hardest with drugs and with crime. And we simply just go up to young folks and tell them, hey, we're out here. We're promoting nonviolence. We're promoting, the act of not using guns to settle conflict. We have flyers that we pass out to young folks. Sometimes we stop, have conversations. We get into very interesting conversations with young folks. We've never had a problem. We've never been sort of resisted, or we've never been met with any type of negative behavior. Actually, folks sort of respect us and give us respect because they say we're brave enough to come out on a Friday night in their hood to talk with them. So it's been positive. It's been strong. And we just want to continue to do that so that we are showing the people in the street community that we do care.
I wonder about this, whether you can answer this or not. There are young men who we know in Baltimore who are involved in drug activity, gang activity. The police commissioner has said that. A couple of police commissioners have said that. So we know that, right? So if you approach young men who are hooked up with gangs, is there a problem with that? Where they're caught in the middle between your message and the gang's message?
I don't think there's a problem for any human being at any point in place, because what we're promoting is life preservation. You know, what we're promoting is the idea of appreciating life and appreciating other people's lives and sort of decreasing this negative impulse of actions to want to end somebody else's, you know, life. So a person that we're talking to may not be thinking about doing something right then. That could change in 24 hours or 48 hours. So as long as we're dropping a seed to say, you know, it's not cool, it's not okay to take someone else's life, to use guns, then, you know, we've done our part to say we've at least done something. We've gone to the target, to the heart of the problem, and we've dropped the seed. And we'll continue to come back to nurture that seed week after week after week.
So your message isn't necessarily leave the gang, change your life.
No.
It's just don't kill. Put down the guns. Don't reach for the gun.
Yes, exactly.
Now, how do you measure, Munir, if you're making a difference? And can you say personally in your interactions on the street whether you feel you're making a difference?
I know we've made a difference from so after sort of the 5th March, we started marching in the exact same area, which was Southwest Baltimore. So the way we were received by people each Friday when we would come out, folks would almost expect to see us out there. Relationships got warmer. I mean, have we brought down the violence? I don't know. But have we made an impact? Have we sort of familiarized ourselves with this neighborhood as a positive force? I know we have indeed. And that's where it starts. You know, so now we want to continue and make this a regular part of Friday nights, that folks in the streets see a group of positive, committed people who aren't afraid are out here promoting this message.
Munir Bihar from the 300 Men March. He's here today to tell us about an event you have coming up tomorrow, right?
Yes.
So what's the call out tomorrow?
So we have a recruitment meeting tomorrow down at our headquarters at 904 Washington Boulevard. And this recruitment meeting is for individuals who want to take part in the marches and individuals who want to help volunteer with some of our communication efforts in getting the information across Baltimore. So this is for both men and women who want to help out logistically or who actually want to be on the front lines and volunteer with the marches.
Now, that's at Munir's Martial Arts Center, right?
Yes, that's
904 Washington Boulevard.
Yes, sir. The Core Community Center.
Core Community Center. And what time do you want folks there?
5 o'clock, 5 p.m. sharp. We'll be starting our meeting, and it'll last about an hour and a half.
Okay. And there's information about this on the Dan Rodrigues Facebook page. We posted a flyer for this event tomorrow night. If you want to, looking for a few good Baltimoreans to help out with this effort in Sandtown, Winchester, and Bel Air, Edison through the 300 Men March. Chief Organizer Munir Bihar. Continue good luck with this, Munir.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you
thank
very
you.
Much. Thank you. Now joining us in Studio A, it's my pleasure to introduce guitarist Pierre Bensouzin, who's in Baltimore for a concert tonight in Baltimore County. Pierre, how are you? Nice to see you in the studio.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Now, how am I doing on pronouncing your name? Bensouzin? I love your name, by the way.
It's good.
It's Bensouzin, probably a lot of people
Ben
say.
Bensouzin sounds exotic to me, but that that works too. Bensouzin, whatever.
Yeah. Well, you've traveled so much. I read that this is your 40th anniversary tour.
That's correct.
40 years on the road.
Not exactly on the road all the time, but from the age of 16, I started to be a full-time musician. So,
and always with the guitar? Started with the guitar?
I started with the piano when I was very young, and then I took the guitar, taught myself when I was about 10 or 11. And
You asked for a guitar, or did you save your money and buy one?
I did not. I was going to play the piano, and my teacher, you know, went away. She went to the south of France. I felt a bit orphaned, and after 6 or 8 months of trying to find somebody else to replace her, I was a little bit depressed, and I stopped playing the piano for a while. And my father thought, wow, okay. So he sold the piano and got me a guitar because he was a big fan of Django Reinhardt.
Oh, Django Reinhardt, okay. Yeah. I bet you are too.
Not then, I was too young to appreciate. But afterwards, of course, yes.
Well, what did you like when you were a kid? Do you remember when you were a teenager?
My first love was Moonlight Sonata of Beethoven played by Arthur Rubinstein.
Really?
That was like, it drove me nuts.
I know, it's mesmerizing.
I was listening to this, just the first movement, of course, all the suite, but that first movement got me in possession, you know.
Do you still listen to the Rubinstein version of it?
I have the vinyl still.
Yeah.
And once in a while, I listen to it.
Right.
And I love all about it, the smell of the cover, the actual touch of the vinyl. I hear the cracks. And it's totally rejuvenating and takes me back to that place. It's like a loop with myself, you know.
And have you played the Moonlight Sonata on the guitar?
I have tried. It's in C sharp, which is very interesting. But there are some movements, some parts of this first movement, which are extremely affordable, and some others quite challenging. But I never really attempt to play it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just enjoy listening to it.
And most of your music is original, is Pierre Bensuzan music, right?
That's correct.
And probably today, probably this week, you're still working on another song, right?
Even on stage.
Toujours, right?
Toujours, yes.
So, Pierre, this is great to have you on our show today. I'm going to tell folks about where they can hear you in concert tonight.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really interesting venue. It's a barn in Baltimore County in Phoenix.
A music barn. Yeah.
So I'll tell you about that, but Pierre, you got to play some music for us first. You have to perform.
I would love to.
Yeah, that's the deal. You play for us a little bit here on Midday. Take your time. We have plenty of time. And then I'll tell folks about the concert. We're going to take a little break in a couple of minutes. So what would you like to play first?
I'm going to play a song that I like to start my concert with. It's called Voyage to Ireland.
Voyage to Ireland. So something on the Celtic side. Huh?
Something on the Celtic side.
All right.
Thank you.
That's Pierre Bensouzin here on Midday Voyage to Ireland. Do you remember when you wrote that?
I was on a boat.
You were literally on a boat?
I was literally on the boat going from Normandy to Rosslare, the west coast, the south coast of Ireland.
Yeah.
I had 22 hours to kill.
Right. How long ago? Do you remember the year?
It was 1977.
Wow, that's pretty good. I mean, Tom Paxton was in here playing the guitar and singing for us, and he's written so many songs. You know, I always wonder, can you even remember all your songs?
I think we do.
Do you remember all your songs?
I don't know if I remember vividly the exact circumstances, but for instance, you asked me that question and the answer came right away. I do remember how that one came about. You know, it's a very intimate personal relationship when you encounter, you have the great fortune to be inspired by something that, you know, just passed by and doesn't even pay attention to you, but you pay attention to that thing and say, hey, wait a minute, come here, please, let me look at you. Right. And you do remember that, you know, you do remember.
Now, there are some songs that please you more than others.
They all please me, depending on the time.
Some, you know. But have some songs, have you stopped playing some because you
many.
Many.
Many. It's like the music visited me and the music went away. Right. You know, I could still play them, but they will be less meaningful for me.
Yeah, some folks might wonder what kind of guitar you're playing today.
It's a Northern Irish guitar.
Is it really?
It's made by George Loudon, who lives in Downpatrick, where St. Patrick is down, in County Down.
Your music ranges from the Celtic to, what would you say? Some people call it world music because they don't know what else to call it.
we belong to this world, but I am inspired by all the musics, including jazz, classical, medieval, baroque, oriental, Celtic. Mm. And I think what I play is a mixture of it, you know, fusion.
Did you have any American influences? You mentioned jazz, but I mean, guitar influences from the United States.
One of my first heroes was Doc Watson, you know, and so, and before him, Pete Seeger and Bob Dylan. So I grew up listening to them, you know, and singing them.
Can you play us something as we go into a break?
Sure.
We're going to take a little break here, and then we'll talk some more with Pierre Bensouzin. If you're familiar with Pierre's music, you want to ask him a question, this is live radio at WYPR. We take phone calls, too, 410-662-8780. So we'll let Pierre play into a break. What would you like to play as we go into a little break?
In fact, a song inspired by Bob Dylan.
Okay, that's good. Nice segue. Merci. Special guest in Studio A today on Midday, Pierre Bensouzin, who will be performing tonight at the Music Barn at Sautier Farm on Cooper Road in Phoenix, Maryland. We posted plenty of information about this concert tonight on the Dan Rodrigues Facebook page. This is a benefit concert for Turnaround Incorporated Baltimore. It's anti-sex trafficking program. And you can get information about that, as I said, on the Dan Rodrigues Facebook page. Tickets are $20 in advance, $25 at the door. The show starts at 8 p.m. tonight. Have you been to this music barn before?
Never.
Huh?
It's like
I haven't either. The photographs look great. It looks like a great
place.
It's
like a house concert, but in a huge environment. It's a place owned by a couple of people. One, I think, is a vineyard owner, and his wife is a classical music singer. And so basically they invite people to play there. They invite the people they like.
I'm familiar with them. Michael Black Sautier and Carolyn, Yeah.
I'm looking forward to meet them.
Yeah, this is terrific. So that's tonight. And folks, you go to like I said, on my Facebook page, there's a couple of links to information about the concert if you'd like to hear Pierre tonight. It's only one night, right?
Only one night, yeah.
I saw your tour schedule, man. You really move.
We drive. It's all driving. Yeah. I come from Los Angeles, went all the way up the coast to all the way to Seattle, cross to go to Spokane, from Spokane to Montana, from Montana to Colorado, from Colorado to Santa Fe, from Santa Fe to to Tennessee, to Chattanooga, and then make my way east.
This is awesome. Where do you go from here? Do you know, or would you have to look at your schedule?
Let me try to remember where do I go. I think I go to Bethlehem, Pennsylvania.
I think you're right. I think I saw that on your schedule.
Tomorrow, in fact.
Before we take some phone calls for Pierre, I wanted to ask you about Michael Hedges, acoustic guitar player, the late Michael Hedges, right?
The late Michael.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And he was here at the Peabody in Baltimore, and you were friends or associate with him.
Yeah, we met several times. We played together. We toured together a little bit, and I was blown away when he wrote that piece named after my name, you know, and I think he turned the attention of a lot of people towards my work.
Mm-hmm.
And he passed away, and I wrote a piece for him, you know.
Do you play that often? Do people request that because they know about your relationship with him?
People, I don't know if they request it, but I think they're moved when I play it, yeah.
Well, maybe you can play for us a little bit of
a
that.
A little bit, okay.
Before the hour's up.
It's called So Long, Michael.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to take a couple calls for you.
Okay.
Now, the first person calling here is calling from Laurel, Maryland.
Okay.
And the name is Paris. So, Paris, welcome to Midday.
Thank you.
And Paris has a question for Pierre Bensouzin.
Hello, Paris. Good morning.
Well, good morning. Two questions. I'm a guitar player, and I come up with little licks and little rhythm bits, but nothing and very few songs. And so I have trouble actually, like, expanding on an idea. So my first question is, so how do you make something a complete song? Or is it that whatever I've come up with is now the song? And the second question is, how on earth do you come up with titles for instrumentals?
Okay. To your first question, I will respond something simple. Just put your guitar aside and listen to the music that you would like to hear inside of you. Try to imagine this music and don't even think to the guitar, because the guitar will attract you to what you know and not necessarily to what you want to play. And so then once this inspiration starts to become vivid in your memory and you can go there whenever you feel like you remember it, you can start even composing silently inside of you. You can even hum with your voice things, you know. And once things starts to be matured and ready, they will sort of tell you, I would like you now to attempt to take me out. And this is when you take your guitar, you see? But if you take your guitar and you don't hear what you want to play, it's your fingers who basically are going to play licks, as you said.
And you'll be stuck with the licks.
And you might be stuck with the licks, you know?
Yeah, yeah, very good.
Is he speaking to you,
Yeah, Paris, was that helpful to you?
I thought that was an excellent answer. I had never even thought about doing that. Because there are many things I hear in my mind that I don't necessarily have the ability to do.
Yeah.
And I have a recording looping station, which does help in that matter. I listen to what I've played, and I come up with new creative, like a bass line or a melody line to a very interesting rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
And so that helps. But I think you're right. I just putting down the guitar and humming it in my mind and even just writing out the notes.
Anywhere you can find. But when I say putting down a guitar, it's an image, you know, it's an allegory. What I mean by that is that a lot of music happens without our instrument. And speaking of instrument, you are the first instrument in the hands of music, not your guitar.
Hmm. Pierre, I was curious about touring, performing, and studio work, and the difference for you, because you have a CD. You have a set out of your concerts, right?
In fact, I just came out to celebrate those 40 years on the road.
Yeah. So I was wondering about that, because to me, that's everything is being in front of the audience and performing.
Yeah.
But you're gonna, the song you played for us earlier, The Voyage to Ireland, could be completely different in front of an audience than it is in a studio.
It could be longer, it could be improvised, it could be a lot of things that pop up at that time, you know, depending on the mood, depending on the sound of the acoustics, depending on the chemistry of the place, depending also on what I've been going through the day before to get there, yeah? What I love about doing a live record, my last record is called Encore. It's a triple live record. We just got nominated by the Independent Music Awards in the category Best Live Performance.
So excellent. Congratulations.
I cross my fingers. But what I really care about this, it is that you don't have time to think. You are on stage. Once you start, you cannot stop. In a recording studio, you can't stop.
Right.
And that's a problem sometimes, because then you are no longer in the real energy and in a real moment that triggers reactions if needed and stuff like that. And on stage, you don't even think about it. You just move on. You go onward, you know. And the music is telling you as it is being unfolded what it needs, where it wants to go. You just have to listen to it. Hmm. And you are a listener as the audience out there is listening too. We are all listening.
And how about the finish? When you finish a song?
You have to hold attention until the very last resonance. You cannot just assume that because you reach the end, that's it. When you do that, sometimes you regret it because you miss something at the end.
Yeah.
And you know, me the listener, I care for every part of the song, especially the ending, you know.
Same here. That moment when the chord lingers and the audience is paused for a moment must mean a lot to you.
Yeah.
Because they have really been listening.
Exactly. The quality of silence, all of that, yeah.
Here's another phone call for Pierre Bensouzin. This is Dave in Baltimore. Welcome to Midday.
Dan, thanks for the show. And Pierre, thanks for the music and the inspiring words.
Good morning.
Good morning. I was with a group of guitar players last night, and we're trying, we're jamming. But I also was at an event in College Park last week regarding Victor Jara, the Chilean singer and composer.
Oh, part of
New Song Movement are trying to get justice in his case, his tragic death in the stadium in Chile in 1973. Mm. But I'm just curious, I asked the screener about music by Victor Jara, Silvio Rodriguez, or even Bruce Coburn, the Canadian musician. I don't know whether you're familiar with any of those.
I am, yeah.
And I don't know if you want to play a song from them, or if you have time or not, but anyway, maybe I'll see you tonight, too.
What about Latin American influences? Bossa Nova. You say you like everything, huh?
Okay.
Huh? Oh.
Let's do a little.
You want to do a little? That wire's in your way. You can remove that now, Pierre. Yeah. So this is a little Bossa Nova? What?
It's one of mine.
Okay. All right, I'll go for it. Very accommodating musician. Thank you, Pierre. P- Pierre Bensouzet, tonight at the Music Barn at Sautier Farm at 14601 Cooper Road, Phoenix, Maryland, 410-526-6367 for more information, or just go on the on my Facebook page and get information about this benefit concert to benefit Turnaround of Baltimore's their anti-sex trafficking program. 410-526-6367. But sit right there, Pierre. I need to take a phone call. This is Paula Gallagher. She is a librarian. She comes on our show once in a while to recommend a couple of books for our listeners to read. Paula, how are you?
I'm good, Dan. Thanks for having me on the show.
I hope you've been enjoying the music here from Pierre.
Yes, I wish I had a good segue for these books coming from that music.
Well, it's not required. Segues aren't required. But just quickly here, there's a couple you wanted to tell us about before the end of the hour. Frances May's Under Magnolia, a Southern Memoir. What's this one, Paula?
Frances Mays was best known for a book called Under the Tuscan Sun, which came out in the early 2000s, and it was made into a movie. She had since written several others about her time living in southern Italy. And this time, she's going back to her childhood roots, and she's talking about how her life was informed by growing up in a small southern town. And we're talking about the 1940s. She grew up in Georgia, a small town called Fitzgerald. And these are stories that she says she had left buried, even though they were such a part of her and her person as a writer, because she had a fear of causing a rift in her family, and that's certainly something a good Southern girl would not do. But she's finally come around to sharing some of these stories, and it's kind of a loose collection of memories, a loose coming of age. Her family was one that had some money. Her father ran a cotton mill, and her mother was one of the ladies who lunched. She would have the women of the neighborhood come over to play bridge. She would throw luncheons. And Frances herself was always aware that there were standards to be met, and you had to live up to appearances. And all the while, these women would come through gossiping about each other. This was a South of segregation, and a South where, even though there were problems in her own family, mostly related to alcohol and her parents fighting and just kind of general, maybe some craziness going on, her bedrock was always the family maid, and her name was Willie Bell. And she lovingly refers to Willie Bell as a one-person domestic industry. And she refers to her as the steady voice that guided her throughout her childhood.
Okay, Paula, we're out of time just about here, so I need to wrap that one up and just remind folks of the title. It's Frances May's Under Magnolia.
Under Magnolia.
A Southern Memoir. And the other one you want to recommend, I just don't have time to talk about it, unfortunately, is A Few Seconds of Radiant Film Strip, A Memoir of Seventh Grade. This one's by Kevin Brockmeyer. You like this one?
I love this one, Dan. Very unusual, reads like a novel, written in the present tense, and the author is referring to himself in the third person. But, you know, it's something that will take you back if you grew up in the 80s, if you came of age, just incredibly evocative. It reminds me a little bit of the TV show Freaks and Geeks, but
okay.
It's the underdog. Yep, it's the underdog.
Right.
It's funny. It's poignant. And just a really good read, very unusual.
Paula G., she's known as on the blog for the Baltimore County Public Library, Paula Gallagher. Again, Frances May's Under Magnolia, A Southern Memoir, A Few Seconds of Radiant Film Strip, A Memoir of Seventh Grade by Kevin Brockmeyer. Our recommendations this month from Paula Gallagher. So, Pierre, thank you very much for being here today. Asked if you wanted to play your song that you wrote about Michael Hedges as we go out of the hour. Would you do that for us?
Okay.
And again, folks, go to my Facebook page if you want to hear Pierre in concert tonight at the Music Barn at Sautier Farm in Phoenix out in Baltimore County. Thank you, Pierre. Just play us right out of the hour then.